This podcast is proudly sponsored by Yukonuba Sporting Dog. If you want to get everything your dog's got, you need nutrition that holds nothing back. To help unleash your dog's maximum potential, check out the new Yukonuba Premium Performance lineup at yukonubasportingdog.com.
Welcome to a new episode of Operation Gundog. We hope you enjoy it.
Welcome back, guys, to Operation Gundog. This episode's a real special one. A lot of hard work went into it. We're sitting here with Matt Neal, and he is the head trainer for East Carolina Retrievers. You guys have probably seen them on Instagram or Facebook. We're going to be sitting here talking with him about his training philosophies and some tips he has for reading dogs, which can help you kind of troubleshoot if you get in a problem with your dogs. So without any further ado, Matt, can you introduce yourself and kind of give us an overview of how you got into gun dog training?
Yes, sir. How's it going, guys? Appreciate you guys having me on. I'm Matt Neal, owner and head trainer of East Carolina Retrievers. I grew up training bird dogs and setters and pointers with my granddad from a real early age. Kind of got a knack for it, you know, before I even knew what gun dogs were, before I really knew, you know, what my life plan was. I was out there, you know, holding a fishing pole with a wing on it and had a pointer working, and my granddad was working the bird dog, and you know, all I knew was I was spending time outdoors and with my granddad and with some dogs, and it was fun. And so went on to play college baseball and got a retriever and started duck hunting a little bit. And I ended up finding a local retriever trainer and started helping him out, and kind of found a passion for retrievers. Kind of, you know, I think that instinct and that passion that my granddad had lit for me kind of ignited again. And so started training retrievers with the guy. And whenever I got done playing college ball, I ended up started a landscape and hardscapes company, and started kind of buying some retrievers on the side and kind of wanted to get back into it. So I ended up finding this little dog, this little black male named Jet. A buddy of mine, he called me and said that a friend of his had bred a litter, and there was two red ones, a male and a female, and there was a black male left. And I was looking a black one. And so I think I paid $400 for Jet. And so I started training him, and one thing led to another, really. I bought a few more dogs and really was just, you know, passionate about it, and started doing it on the side, you know, after work, before work. And then people kind of took note of what I was doing with them. Buddies were, you know, coming hunting with me and watching some of my dogs work, and they were interested in, you know, where I got them from. And I'd had a litter at that point in time, and so I sold some friends a puppy and kept a few of them for training, and a few other people had asked me about training their dogs, and so I was kind of training, you know, a few retrievers here and there on the side, mainly just gun dogs and whatnot, and just kind of doing it as a side hustle, as a hobby, if you will. And then I did that for a couple years, and I decided that I was going to go run a hunt test, and my life has not really been the same since then, I guess you could say.
And I went and ran finished, and probably didn't have any business running finished, really. I picked up I went to that test to watch. It was the first test that I'd ever been to. And on the way there, I was like, you know, I'm just going to run. I'm here, like, whatever, you know. And so I signed up for finished. I went over there. I was late, I got walked up late, and then like everyone, you know how it is, like it's all cliquish and like everyone knows everybody. Well, you know, I pull up in my white Duramax, and everybody's like, well, who is this cat, you know? And so I walk up like to the handlers meeting late, you know, and so then I run, and I watched a few dogs run, and I run, it was a triple and a blind. I ran the triple, picked it up, and ran the blind pretty clean. Got called back to water, which obviously in HRC, you know, you can run either way. I didn't fail immediately, which was kind of kind of what I was going for. And so then got to water and ran a water triple, picked it up. And then there was a down to shore blind. And at that point in time, I had no idea even what a down to shore blind was. And so Jet, he ran down the shore instead of swimming down the shore, like, you know, like he was supposed to. And so I ended up failing because of that. But after that, I would never forget, there's a guy named Dwayne Padgett, and he's got a couple Hall of Fame dogs, and his wife, both of them come up to me and, you know, ask me if it was my first test, and you know just very inviting, and you know, he gave me some pointers, and you know he just kind of invited me back to say, hey, you know, don't get frustrated, don't hold your head down, you know, it happens to everyone, you know, just we'll be happy to help you out if you need anything. And you know, it was kind of that one person that really brought me back to you know, wanting to do it again, you know what I mean, versus saying like, it's not really for me, whatever, I think that's stupid, like if I can pick a duck up hunting because I want a hunting dog, I don't need to do that. And, you know, make the excuse for my dog not being good enough.
For you, was the first hunt test you ran that finished level hunt test?
It was. It was.
Really, really swinging for the fences there, huh?
It was. And that, you know, man, that was a mistake. I mean, honestly, it really was. I should have just went and watched, and I would have realized that I really just had some more training to do to get there. But, you know, man, that's just kind of how I am. And, you know, I don't mind failing. And, I think you learn a lot from your failures. And I'm kind of that game time person where I feel like I learn the most when I'm in the moment and, just kind of in the zone, if that makes sense.
Oh yeah.
It's hard to learn it without experiencing it. I got to ask, how old was he when you were trying out these finished hunt tests, and how old is he now?
Jet at that time was about a year and a half. I think he was a little younger than a year and a half. Somewhere around there, somewhere around 18 months. And he was just too young, just a little immature. And kind of going off of that, I mean, and this can kind of go into some of our topics, but, you know, doing that really set us back and set me back with him as far as running tests, because I had a lot of habits that I had to fix after that. You know, you let a dog go to a test and then run run down the shore or down the bank and pick up the bird and come back. I mean, it takes quite a bit of training to kind of unwind that, if that makes sense. And so I had a lot of challenges ahead of me after that. I actually failed a junior test, not too long after that with a client's dog. And that was kind of, embarrassing, I guess you can say, but, you know, it's like I said, your failures kind of make you better, and you learn from them and try not to make those mistakes again. And heck, I mean, we all fail tests for different reasons. Sometimes it's the handler's fault. Sometimes it's the dog's fault. And sometimes it's both. And sometimes we get it right. You know, it's just part of the game. I think you just got to remember it's just a game. And at the end of the day, like, you can be as competitive as you want, but dogs are going to be dogs, and they're going to make you look stupid sometimes. You know?
For sure. For sure. I know, you know, me and Sailor's first hunt test, we ended up failing that first day. So we failed out on water. We had some issues there, and it ended up being a hard water test. I came back the second day and everyone was talking about how, you know, over half the dogs ended up failing water and test dog was running the setup poorly just off the bat, which should have been an indication of things to come. But out of all the dogs that failed, of course, me and Sailor were the first dog to fail. So we were dog number three on that setup. So, yeah, I had a lot of people in the gallery watching this dude walk up with his poodle and then watch a poodle try to get in the water. Not something I'd ever really experienced with her too much, except for like the week before the hunt test when I was kind of focusing too much on cheating the bank with a dog that I was about to run started with. And I kind of went into that in one of our previous episodes, but you know, I know Matt, you saw that firsthand cause I was down there with you guys and, you helped me work through some of that. But you know, if it hadn't been me at the line with my dog and running that test and failing it, one, you learn more from your failures, like you said, and two, it is so easy to sit there in the gallery if you don't have a dog and think, my dog would absolutely rock this setup.
Oh yeah.
And
yeah, for sure.
You know, having your dog with you at the line, because even you, like you said, just going to watch it, you might have watched it and been like, Jet's not going to cheat on me. Like, Jet's going to run straight to the thing, through the water, swim right down the shore, stay wet, pick it up, come back. And, you know, you might not have known that until he's put in that situation where he gets the opportunity to cheat that he would. You know, it's one of those things that till you're there actually handling, you just don't know what your dog will do, but we're always confident that our dogs can do their best all the time.
That's right. And I mean, if you've never been on the line or on the bucket in front of two judges at all, I mean, man, it's a pretty good adrenaline rush. It kind of brings me back to my ball playing days. You know, it's fun, man. That's, you know, I haven't had that adrenaline rush, you know, other than hunting. It's hard to find anywhere that gives you that same adrenaline rush other than hunt tests and field trials. So that's kind of what brought me, you know, to like it as much as I do.
So you mentioned playing ball in college and feeling that rush walking up to the line, kind of like you're walking up to the plate. Do you have a certain walk up song that plays in your head while you're walking there with the dog?
Oh man, I definitely get hype on the way to a hunt test or to a trial, but once I get there, I kind of zone out and really just like focus on my dogs. And I don't know, man, I can't really explain it, but it you just kind of zone out, and it's just that one-on-one time with your dog that, you know, for me, training dogs every day, and you know, I'm trying to be as efficient and, you know, not rush but be efficient, and you don't really get that intimate one-on-one time that often. So that's kind of my time to, you know, just hang out and spend some time with my dog. I try to just zone out and relax. I don't really have a walk up song.
Well, I just, you know, I figured it'd be something like Thunderstruck or Paint It Black or, you know, something, right? Yeah, I figure even if you don't have one now, the next hunt test you go to, I'll probably throw you off because you'll be thinking, what song should I think of?
Uh-huh. Yep.
But, so overall, you know, talking about Jet being your first dog within this hunt test ring, did you ever notice he, you know, had any issues with being too timid, or was he just all around a balanced dog from the get-go, or did you have to work through some issues with him early on?
That's a good question. Jet's a great dog, first off, and to put up with me going from, you know, because in the beginning of my training, whenever I was younger, whenever I was in high school, the guy I worked for, he run hunt tests and I bird void for him and clean kennels and all that. And his training methods were, they weren't bad, but I do things differently. And they're just a little harsher than I like, you know? And so, you know, it is what it is, but I learned from it. And I think sometimes you learn things from people. You learn more from people of what not to do than what to do sometimes. And so, you know, you watch, you learn, say, okay, that's not for me. And you move on and you find something else. And you find something that fits your style and fits what you're looking for. And so, you know, with Jet, it's been a interesting road, to say the least, because when I first got him,
you know, I started off more positive reinforcement training methods, British style training methods, if you will. I was learning from a UK based trainer. You know, I bought into like Robert Milner's like Duck Hill, his program. And I found some pretty good success with it, not gonna lie. I think it taught me a lot as far as how to read dogs and how to, you know, how to like really learn behaviorisms of dogs. I think I already had a pretty good knack and idea of that just from my background and whatever with animals. But I think that kind of gave me a new insight to it with dogs, as far as clicker training and positive reinforcement and learning, you know, the different quadrants of training. However, when I started running hunt tests, I realized that I didn't have the control that I needed to be as precise as I needed to be to excel in hunt tests. And, you know, and then it kind of, I think this is where the divide amongst hunters versus hunt test field trial people comes in. And I think it happened to me, and it took me, I don't know why I kept going, but that is what it is. But, you know, a lot of people would have just said, man, screw this, after like failing two and being like really embarrassed. Most people would have just said, all right, this is not for me. Like, I enjoy hunting with my dogs and they're pretty good, whatever. But, you know, the competitor in you says, nah, like, I'm gonna figure this thing out and I'm gonna get better. And, you know, so that's what kind of drove me back to it. And, you know, the thing about it is when you start holding your dogs to those higher standards, and I think the other thing, and I think this will kind of get into our conversation more, but, you know, when you have those high standards and you have those goals, like of those levels, like of junior, senior, master national, you know, when you have those like set out goals of like, I want to accomplish this by this time and this by this time, you know, it's funny how when you write out your goals and you lay them out and like, this is what I'm going to do, then you can figure out a plan and figure out a roadmap to be able to achieve it. But if you just say, I want this, you know, this finished gun dog, well, you know, people say, I want a finished gun dog. Well, what is a finished gun dog to you? Because I've hunted with a lot of people that they call their dog a finished gun dog, but it ain't nowhere near being finished. The test allows you to, you know, really say, okay, this dog is proven that he's this. Now, whether he can hunt is a different story, but he's proven that he can do these things to this high standard. He can learn to hunt through a transition phase. But on the back end, someone says, I've got this hunting dog. There's a lot of gray area that can be left there, you know.
I'm kind of curious, whenever you were transitioning him over, did you feel the need to go back through everything that you had originally went through and more of like a UK style? For instance, like, I'm sure you would have done hold conditioning, and did you go back through and do force fetch and some of the other things that would be a little different?
Man, that's the thing. So I had gotten him pretty much to a finished level without a collar. And, you know, I say that now like an idiot, but realistically, it caused me way more problems, because I at 2 years old, I started back over completely like with puppy stuff and started back over, went back through hold conditioning, went back through force fetch, or went through force fetch the first time. You know, and that was my guinea pig again, because I didn't feel comfortable going and doing it with someone else's dog necessarily. And so I was like, all right, well, I'm not scared to do it with him. He's mine. And so he was the guinea pig, but it ended up being the best thing for him. I started back over, and you know, it didn't take another year, year and a half, and I felt like we were way past a point that I ever thought that we could be. And then, you know, I don't remember exactly when it was, but whenever he got his HRCH, and I remember telling my buddy Paul, I was like, you know, I think I'm probably good with this. Like, I don't think he can do anymore. And then, like, we just kind of keep training, and like, I kind of give him a little time off, and we hunt, and he's like, put him back on the truck and starts training again and looking real good. And I was like, I had to run a senior dog and put a title on her. And I was like, well, I run senior with her. And so then I run senior, and he's like, I mean, obviously he does really well. And like, it was too easy for him. But I was like, you know, I was like, all right. And so I was like, well, maybe we could run master then. And so started running master and failed the first one. He cheated the corner, and it was like, man, it was like, you know, master's quite a bit cheatier than finished is, and they'll get you for it. And so that was one thing that I had to learn and kind of change in my training, was how to teach a dog like corner cheaters, and, you know, just how to make a dog a little more watery. And I didn't understand that. And so that was a little bit of a learning curve for me. But you know, through the whole process, Jets kind of stuck with me, and we failed that one for him cheating, and then we failed one more. So he was 6 for 8 running master to get his title, and then I think he's picked up like 4 or 5 more passes since then. And I think I'm gonna try to run nationals with him, and I'm gonna run the grand with him. And he's a good little dog, man. He's fun to run. I mean, he's like 52 pounds. I mean, he's just like full of muscle, and it's like, he's like that dog that, you know, me and him are a team, and if I tell him to go somewhere, he's like, all right, boss, man. All right, whatever you say, you know.
So, that's what you want. Y'all been through a lot together. He's been through 2 full training programs with you, man.
Two training programs, 4 houses. Well, I guess 5 if you consider the kennel that we just moved out of. Man, he's been through it all. Now he's putting up a little screaming baby downstairs. he's definitely one of a kind, man.
So, you know, with, you know, him going through all the, you know, I guess every training process again, how did you know when he was ready to advance and move on to something new? And do you feel like it was easier for him?
Humans think in timelines, and dogs have no reference of time. All right. And so we usually screw ourselves up by trying to put our dogs on a timeline. So in our kennel, we've got our list, or our step-by-step, if you will. And there is no timeline beside any of it. I've got my months laid out every day, and it's basically the same thing every month. It changes, obviously the setups change, but the routine stays the same. There is no timeline that we put on our dogs, and I think we're successful because of that. Dogs like Mocha, The unconfident dogs, the fearful dogs, the timid dogs, all of them dogs. Patience does them a world of wonder. And when we don't put them and constrict them to a timeline, we let them grow and develop like they should. And sometimes you just got to give them a little bit of time off, and they turn out to be just what you hoped for. You know, when it comes to moving on in training, though, you know, I think, and it kind of goes back to this teach, reinforce, and then force method, you know, that's our philosophy. We're going to teach, say, with treats, we're going to reinforce with a leash, and then we're going to force with an e-collar. And I think that method, it works. It's been proven to work. It's pretty foolproof. And I think once we're through with the forcing aspect of it, then the dogs show that they can push through doing what we're asking with a little bit of light collar pressure while we're asking it. And if they can pull through that, then, you know, we start raising up the distraction levels and the excitement levels and still ask it of them. And if they can do that, then we're ready. When it comes to T pattern, I mean, I think the end of T pattern for me is reverse T, and being able to force with a bumper in their mouth and cast is when I feel like my dogs are ready to leave T pattern.
That brings up a question. You know, are you, say we're working, I don't know, pile or whatever it might be, and we're getting ready to get to the point where, you know, T is our next step, whether you're working, you know, cold blinds or whatever it is with those transition dogs, or, you know, trying to get them set up to start running T, right? Are you looking for 100% perfection with that dog? Are you looking for failure with understanding? Are you looking for failure and understand the collar correction and then get success out of it? What is your mile marker for, okay, this dog is ready to advance to the next thing with regards to like blind work?
Great question. I think I like to get it to where we're about 75%, 85% maybe. You're going to see days where, and I think this is where balance comes into play, because when you balance out your training days and training weeks, training months, you have dogs that get out the trailer and want to go to work versus dogs that are bored with the work. And a dog that's bored with the work is going to give you some more problems that maybe shouldn't be there, or that are going to cause more problems and are not necessary, versus a dog that's excited about their work because you've balanced out your training correctly, is excited about being there, is running hard and willing to get through it a little faster with pressure, without a problem, so that you can move on and move forward. Sometimes when you try to take that from 75-85% to 95-100% perfection, then you start taking the drive out of the dog, is what I've seen, at least in my experiences.
Like, you're kind of making them bored of it because you're you know, absolutely hammering them on perfection.
Well, if I look at it like this, I played college baseball, and if I hit 300, then I felt pretty good about myself. And I usually hit over 300, but if I hit 300, that was 3 out of 10 times I got a base hit. Okay. And in the cage, you know, if I hit 10 balls, I don't expect myself to hit all 10 perfect. I try to hit 6 or 7 perfect, because there's going to be those times of error where, even though you gave it your best effort, you just didn't hit the ball right. Nature got the best of you, right? And so it's not fair to put perfection on your dog because it's just not realistic. You got to look at effort, and if they're given effort and given good effort, and they just make honest mistakes, well, maybe it's time to start challenging them a little bit more. And you know, you can kind of see if they're ready to move on. But dogs that are not given an effort, it's hard to, once you get to that point, it's hard to take it back out. You know what I mean? It's hard to get it back out once you get there.
That makes a lot of sense. And that, I think that's probably going to change the way I look at some things, you know, trying to consider it being in a batting cage or hitting some BP or something like that. You know, you want perfection, but it's not realistic to, you know, go 10 for 10, go yard every time or anything like that. But that brings me to another question. You know, we're looking for a good, consistent dog, but not necessarily a perfect dog. And when you're looking to issue a collar correction, what's kind of your mentality of when to issue a collar correction and when, you know, when to maybe use some attrition or some vocal corrections over collar overlay?
Lack of effort is something I think that both with dogs and people is controllable. And so I feel very comfortable giving corrections on lack of effort. I like indirect pressure, but I think lack of effort is usually the root of me giving pressure to a dog.
What about like in an instance where you're issuing a cast, right? And that dog is, you know, giving you 100%, but they're giving you 100% in the wrong direction or something like that. How do you kind of approach a collar correction in that situation?
I'm not going to go to collar pressure before attrition. So when we're casting, we use the method of we're going to ask you, we're going to tell you, and then we're going to make you. So we're going to give you the choice by asking, then we're going to tell you with a step and with some firmness, and then we're going to make you with a correction. Okay? And so it's a very fair way of being systematic in, you know, having a clear and concise communication way of like, okay, maybe you didn't understand the first time, maybe you didn't see it well, so I'm going to give you a little extra with the step this time to make sure you see which direction I'm saying go. And then when you turn around and go the other way, then I'm going to give it to you one more time and I'm going to give you some more. And then after that time, I'm going to give you a correction. After that correction, and say, okay, so let me break that back down a little bit. So you blow the whistle, you give the cast, the dog starts to take it and then starts to go back their way. So you blow the whistle again. You give them the same cast with the step and they start to go that way and then they go back to where they were going again. You blow the whistle again. You're going to give it with some more body English, some more step, some more, no, not verbal, just some more language in your cast to say, hey, that's not the right way. If they do not give it to you, then another whistle and then a correction after they put their butt on the ground and they're looking back at you, a light correction, and then I will call them back to me to say, okay, if you're not going to give me what I'm asking, you're going to get corrected for it, and then I'm going to bring you back. And so what I'll do is bring you back to the place that I sat you down initially where I asked you to give me what I was looking for. And then I'll give less of a cast this next time to make them give me more of an adjustment. And that may be a little much, but, you know, I'm going to make them do right by me. And both with a little bit of pressure, a little bit of attrition, and not just giving them the easy way out, they learn that I am right and it's a fair way to be able to give corrections after the third time of blowing you off and doing it their way.
You kind of touched on it there a little bit, but you know, you're talking about high drive dogs that need to absolutely plow, like wrap themselves around a tree before they realize they're off the road. And then Jet is a little bit different. What about on the far other end of the spectrum where you're working with a dog that is just super timid, really in its shell? You know, does that affect the way or the timing or the amount of pressure you use with the collar correction? Do they maybe get, you know, ask, tell, then make? Or is it still the same program that you do with that dog? You just adjust your pressure?
No, it doesn't change at all. The amount of pressure may change, but the way that we teach and the standard doesn't change. Because it is so fair and so clear, and we start it in our foundational work so early on when we get going both in obedience and in the T pattern, that by the time we get there, we're well understood.
Oh, yeah, okay. So this kind of goes in with, you know, all of the you know, you're talking about collar conditioning and, you know, teaching new concepts and, you know, reinforcing. How do you find balance? And is there like a built-in routine with, hey, you know, we're learning new concepts this day, but tomorrow we're going to shoot live flyers to kind of, you know, build in some confidence and boost everyone's morale? Or is that kind of touch and go? You know, basically, are you waiting for the, you know, the dog to get a little sour before you introduce those things, or is that stuff just on the schedule?
Yeah, it's definitely dog dependent, to an extent. But I've got kind of a program and a step by step deal that I follow. But there again, you know, every dog's different, and when it comes to birds, I think that's where it really, kind of differentiates between dogs. Some are going to need a lot more and some are going to need less, and some may need to pick them all up and others may need to see them and never pick them up. It just kind of depends on the dog there, but you just kind of got to balance it out dog for dog. But there again, within that dog, you kind of got to balance out your days and your weeks to, like I said, you know, like I was saying earlier, to kind of keep that momentum and, you know, keep a dog that's happy to get out of the box and happy to work. And I think that kind of goes down to, you know, proper nutrition and, like feeding times and airing times and, you know, being hydrated and, you know, the way that you train and how often and all that good stuff kind of goes into that. And so I think all that stuff's important for, you know, like getting the most performance out of them that you can.
That makes a lot of sense. I guess another thing that I've been thinking about, you know, with those dogs that you can't find the balance, what does that look like? And do you have, you know, dogs that you have to send home for a little while just because they're not mature enough yet for some of these more difficult concepts? And what would that look like? Do you have any examples?
You know, they're all different. And I think when we try to put like humans are very into time frames and timelines, and, you know, dogs know no time. And so I think when we try to put time frames on our training, you know, we kind of shoot ourselves in the foot a little bit because we naturally get in a hurry. And you know, that's why my monthly schedule has no month on it. It's just day to day. So I mean, it's I think when you follow a step by step and you say, okay, when we get this down, we'll move forward. But as far as what month it is, what week it is, that really doesn't matter. As long as we're progressing, then I'm happy. And I've watched dogs, and it takes 3 or 4 months to finally click, And once it does, it's like a light switch turns on and everything we've taught those past 3 months actually meant something and they actually did want to do it. And, you know, this all good things happen. And then I've had dogs that, you know, they get to month 4, 5, 6, and they're kind of like, okay, I'm over this. Like, I'm ready to go home. You know, we're, you know, mom and dad keeps coming and hanging out and training with us and seeing us and all this, but, you know, I'm over training. And I think those dogs are, you know, just as tough because you got to learn how to keep them happy. You know, I mean, birds, I think, is the, you know, birds in real situations, you know, dogs that know better and know what training looks like versus what real life hunting situations look like. You better make training fun for them or else they'll kind of get that lackadaisical attitude about you.
Right. Yep. Don't want to deal with that.
You know, that brings up a good question I have about, you know, working with different types of dogs. What's the difference? You know, you're talking about, you know, maybe some dogs are more meant to be meat dogs and others, but how can you tell the difference between a fearful dog and a dog that lacks confidence? And is there a difference between those two things?
You know, I think there, all right. So there's definitely a difference in the two. I think it can be difficult to differentiate between, you know, what is fear and what's lack of confidence. I think it depends on the situation too. You know, you kind of got to look at the back history and backstory on those experiences that the dog's been in and what's created, what could be fear, or is it just simply lack of experience? And so that's, you know, leading to a lack of confidence. You know, I think both of them can kind of usually be treated in the same way. You know, I don't think, in my opinion, I try to result to positive, you know, reinforcement or attrition first, and then, you know, pressure or forcing something secondly. And so, you know, I think with both of those issues, you know, going that route and just, you know, breaking it down over a period of time and being consistent, you know, will end up with good results. You just got to be patient with them.
What's the difference between a dog that lacks confidence and a fearful dog?
All right. So when you sit a dog down for the first time and they look at the water and they run back to the kennel, I would call that fear. When you do that and you throw a bumper and they kind of tiptoe in and they kind of like play with the water and like, you know, they're kind of like dabbling with it and they're just not quite sure. They're okay with it as long as, you know, their feet are touching the bottom. And so they're just like easing in and then they might go down a few feet and try somewhere else. Like that is lack of confidence. That's not fear. You know, avoidance is more of what I would consider in the fear department. Then, you know, just some slight, you know, reluctancy, but still being curious kind of shows lack of confidence. But I mean, like I would say, I mean, all right. So the dog that I just mentioned that ran back to the kennel the first time I ever showed her the water, like it's the poodle pointer that I shot all them ducks over not too long ago. And you know what I mean? And so whether it's fear or lack of confidence, the fix for that is live birds. Like if they're going to be a duck dog, then live birds would generally fix most fear or confidence issues. When we're talking about balance in dogs, live birds keeps the balance going in dogs in their training, you know?
Gotcha. So we've kind of talked about a whole spectrum of different dogs, right? We've talked about the dogs that need to absolutely ram into a light pole. Talked about the dogs that as soon as they start to hit that rumble strip, they come back and keep between the ditches. If you had a pick between a dog with super high drive that maybe it's just, you know, lacking some intelligence, like it's just going to take a lot longer for them to grasp concept, versus a dog that you need to build drive on, but they're a more intelligent dog that, you know, just grasp things quickly, they just need drive built. Which one of those two dogs would you prefer?
I'll take one of both. I think that's the art of dog training, right? And, you know, the thing about it is, man, the being able to adapt, right? Being able to adapt and being able to train different dogs is the fun of it for me. You know, all different types, different personalities, different problems, the same problem, you know, same problem and the same fix doesn't fix it. You know, all these different things. To me, being able to read and understand those personalities, you know, it allows me to change and adapt my program just a little to fit those dogs' needs and really probably more so fit my owner's goals. You know, and at the end of the day, it's not about what I would rather do. It's my job to turn them both out to be good, balanced dogs, right? So how do we take the dummy with high drive and make him be smart and sensible and keep his drive? And then how do we take the intelligent dog and make them quit thinking so damn much and just do it?
I've got a dummy that I own and I love him to death, and he's got more drive than any other dog on my truck. And, you know, today he ran a 325 yard mark, a 270 something, and like a 180. And I kid you not, he didn't move 5 yards off his line to all three of them. I mean, like, just smoked them, buddy. And then some days, you know, like, we run a field trial not too long ago, and, you know, they shoot the triple, and then the flyer's the last bird out, and he runs, like, 300 yards past the flyer, and I end up picking him up and going back home. Like, you know, and just, that's my dummy with high drive, you know? And some days he's good, and some, you know, and when he's good, he's the best thing you've ever seen. And when he's not, then he's wrong. And the thing about him is, those dogs are going to give you 100%, whether they're right or wrong. They're going to give you their all. I think you just have to, it goes back to, you know, what we talked about earlier with Tucker. You have to change their perception of what's going to happen. And when you start doing that, you start making them be more sensible, because they learned that they weren't right when all they do is just go balls to the wall and don't think. However, on those intelligent dogs, you know, when you're building drive with them, I enjoy seeing that light switch turn on in a dog like Sailor. Like, I remember that day when that light switch turned on with her with that duck. And then, you know, you watch that grow and grow and grow. And in a year or so, you see that dog, you know, just crushing it. And you would have never known that that dog had any sort of lack of drive in the beginning, you know? And so I feel good about being able to take both of those dogs and in the end, making them be balanced and be sensible, but both have drive. So, like I said, I'll take one of both.
And I got another question as we start to wrap things up. You know, a lot of people will say, hey, what do I do with X concept? My dog is just being stubborn. What are your thoughts on stubborn dogs, and what do you think the root of that is?
All right, so that we call that dog Tucker. That dog is Tucker, and he is very good, and he's cocky, and he knows he's good, and he's damn good. And he's so good that he gets himself in trouble because he thinks that he's always right. The stubborn can be used and is used a lot of times as an excuse for not being trained well enough. And that's being very blunt, I know, but usually stubbornness is a direct reflection of like lack of training, and maybe the training is done to a certain extent, but in a certain distraction or at a certain distraction level or in a certain environment, that goes away. And so now they're stubborn, right? And so I think it, when you break it down, even in the field, and you say, you know, a dog's stubborn, was he being stubborn? If you're telling him what to do, then is he being stubborn, or did you just not teach him correctly? And I think it most of the time comes back to didn't teach correctly, but didn't teach thorough enough with enough distractions in a high enough, you know, distraction environment to really get that dog amped to the level that he's not listening to you and being stubborn at. Did you train him at that level, or were you training him in a controlled, you know, very low stimulated, mental stimulated environment? And that's where you were getting success. And so you thought you were good. And then that's usually the case where most people say, okay, I'm going to move on. And then when their dog gets excited, then they don't listen again. And they can't figure it out, but it's because they usually don't train at that. They don't train their dog at a jacked up level.
Gotcha. I like that part about, you know, stubbornness might actually be a lack of training too. I think that's always something good to keep in mind. You know, if your dog's being stubborn, maybe, you know, you're pointing the finger at your dog, but you got a couple more fingers pointing right back at you. It's always something to consider. You know, have I thoroughly explain this concept for this dog, or is that why it's coming off as stubborn, because they're just not understanding? Well, John, do you have any more questions?
No, man, I think that just about covered everything I have.
Matt, if you had to get any color poodle, what color poodle would you get?
A black one, no doubt. It would definitely be black.
Yeah. Is Sailor still your favorite poodle to ever run on your property?
Sailor's still my favorite poodle.
Still the only poodle too, right?
Yeah, Sailor's the only one, but she's still the favorite.
Love it. All right. Well, Matt, we appreciate your time. We appreciate your insight. We appreciate you kind of inviting us into your mind as a trainer and running through some different scenarios and some different dogs with us. And helping me and John grow as trainers, and helping our listener grow as trainers as well.
Yeah, man, I can't thank you guys enough, and I really enjoyed it. It's always good chatting dogs with some good guys. So I appreciate the invite, and we'll have to do it again.
For sure.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. I'm envisioning a troubleshooting episode down the road.
I'll leave that to you guys.
Well, with all that being said, John, do you want to run into some updates? I feel like we haven't done updates in a couple of weeks.
Oh, man. Yeah, sure. Let's do it. So for me, I moved to a new place on some land about 3 weeks ago. And in that, I've been very busy. I don't have any client dogs right now. I get a new one tomorrow. But it's just a dog for obedience. I'm not really advertising right now. I'm trying to kind of get myself in order, get my fences built, get my kennel built. I have the building, but I have to kind of build it out. Everything that I need in there. I have so much going on right now that I actually sent my dog, my main test dog, Bonnie, who I ran seasoned with in October. I sent her to a training buddy of mine for the month to kind of help me have a little time to get things in order and still make sure that she's getting what she needs without having to take a step back while I'm kind of running low on daylight hours and getting stuff ready at the house. So I sent her there a couple of weeks ago, and I've only got to go out there and see her twice, but I'm hoping to get out there again this week. But she's doing really good, and he has plenty of ability to stretch her out and keep her exercising and whatnot for the month while I get it together here. That's about the biggest updates I have for myself.
I hear you, man. I started a new job myself, so I'm definitely learning about running out of daylight hours with this new schedule. Whenever I get home, it's already dark. So with me and Sailor, we've been running through trying to get her up to running blind. So we're kind of focusing on that whole force to pile, send to pile, whatever you want to call it, trying to get her up to T pattern level. So that's about all I can do in the dark is, set up a pile, set up a white pole, something like that, and just kind of run through things there. I have added a new member to my chicken coop. People listening, you may or may not have seen on Instagram yet, but the chicken coop has gained one new avian member. So I got a duck. Her name is Daphne, and she is the new mascot, I guess, for the puddle hound. So with that, just the other day, I took her out and threw her and let Taylor go pick her up, and she absolutely loved it. It's kind of been a little bit of a hole in her training not to be able to get on live birds. The first time she saw a live bird was with Matt, I don't know, probably about 4 months ago. And then the second time she saw a live bird was with Matt about 3 months ago in the water. And so I figured it was about time that that we brought one here to kind of spice things up with their training and to break up monotony and also kind of train out a little bit of that think and train in a little bit of just go. And, the first times I was throwing that bird, it was just go. So I think that's going to be a valuable tool for us moving forward. And definitely been continuing to sprinkle in water stuff. Her water confidence is definitely getting way up there from where it was, just 2 months ago. So we're continuing to build on momentum and, seeing where she can continue to excel at.
Heck yeah.
It's fun to watch a dog chase a duck.
For sure. For sure. It's been fun to watch her drive increase too. Each time I see her, it seems like her drive's, gradually growing and growing and growing. And man, those live birds, that's what, I tell people all the time, man, when they start hunting a dog, like, just be patient. Just be patient. About 75 birds in, something clicks, and they're just like, they start to figure the game out. And so you just kind of got to give it time, I think patience is the virtue when it comes to everything in life, but especially when it comes to our dogs.
For sure. And I've definitely noticed, you mentioned her drive growing since the first times you have seen her. I think her drive grows as I grow as a trainer. The more I learn to, like you said, we're not pushing perfection. The more I learn to, take a concept, all right, we're at 75, 80%, on to the next one. I've noticed her come out of her shell a lot more too. And, it's not boring to her. It's exciting. It's fun. She enjoys her job. So we're going to keep rolling on with that.
Nice. Good deal. Good deal. Well, hey, I appreciate you guys having me on. I got a little baby girl to tend to.
Yeah, those are fun, aren't they?
Well, we appreciate all of your time. We will definitely have to get together sometime soon. I'll have to make another road trip down east and pay you guys a visit sometime here in the near future.
Yes, sir. You're welcome. Welcome anytime. Welcome anytime.
Yeah. Thanks again for coming on, Matt. Appreciate you.
Yes, sir. Appreciate you guys having me. I'll talk to you later.
All right. Well, we want to say a big thank you to all of our listeners. You know, without you guys, this podcast would just be two guys that, you know, call random trainers on the phone. So we thank you all. We hope you guys are able to take away as much from these episodes as we are. I know I personally grow as a trainer every time I hear a different trainer talk and get to ask them questions. So we hope we're hitting questions that you guys would ask yourselves. With all that being said, if you enjoyed our podcast, please leave us a review. You know, give us some stars at the bottom if you're on Apple, or leave us a written review of what you think of the podcast. And if you really like it too, and you've done all that, feel free to reach out to us as well. We love hearing from people who are enjoying the podcast. We love hearing from all of our fans. It's awesome when you guys reach out to us and tell us how much you're enjoying the podcast. And it's even cooler. I was telling John, I reached out to somebody, was talking to them about my dog, and they're local to me, and mentioned the podcast to them, and they said, "Oh yeah, you know, I actually just tuned into that last week." It kind of blew my mind that, you know, that we have all these listeners from all over the place. So we thank you all. We appreciate you sticking with us, and we can't wait to release a new podcast for you guys. So make sure you're subscribed so you get notified whenever we drop those.